Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and can you put a price on peace of mind? Why, yes, you can.
From about $200 to about $2,000.
That's Mark Sepulveda with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Mark sells alarm systems, and he says installing one in your home will run you
from about $200 to about $2,000.
But here's a quiz. Which of the following cheap alternatives has also proven to deter thieves? Perhaps it's A, growing hedges so crooks can't see into your home. Or is it effective to B, put up a sign that says you have an alarm system, even if you don't? Or is a cheap solution C, to avoid telling anyone you're going to be out of the house? 53% of the time, families are burgled by people they know. Only one choice is right, so make your guess and stick around. The answer is on this week's Marketplace Money, next from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Credit cards. Most of us have a love-hate relationship with them. Love them when they let us have that extra nice dinner out. Hate them when that so-called fixed interest rate is suddenly unfixed. Riding to our rescue, the Federal Reserve. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
The credit card industry has taken a beating lately. Two documentaries hit theaters this spring, blasting card companies for helping plunge us into massive debt. Congress is looking into various slimy-sounding industry practices. And now, this week, the Fed proposed making it easier to understand the mumbo-jumbo in our bills. Greg McBride is here to explain. He's with Bankrate.com. And Greg, for those of us who cannot abide reading the fine print, it could literally get bigger, huh?
There are some big print changes that you'll see if this is instituted. Specifically, even a change in terms, instead of being tucked into some disclosure agreement that comes in the envelope along with glossy brochures and your account statement, they would actually have to put that on the account statement. Now, another aspect of these proposed changes is the fact that any change in terms, they would have to give you 45 days notice rather than the current 15, the idea being let's give consumers a little bit more time to evaluate their options. One that's long, long overdue is tightening the reins on the use of the term fixed rate. Many consumers believe, and rightfully so, when they have a fixed rate credit card, the rate will never change. In reality, it's fixed rate in credit card parlance has really only meant fixed until the issuer decides to change it.
This is the first time that the Fed has taken a look at changing these rules since, what, 1981? What's prompting it now?
There's been a lot of clamoring that it's time to update these disclosure agreements. The fact is, this movement to take another look at it is a step in the right direction and one that many would argue is long overdue.
How's the credit industry reacting to this?
The credit industry, predictably, they put on a good face. But, you know, as with anybody, if somebody came into your office and said, we're going to change how you do your job and make it a little more difficult for you, we'd have some issues with some of that. And there is about a four-month comment period through which the Federal Reserve will gather comments from both the industry as well as consumer groups before they craft the final revision.
What impact, if any, could this move by the Fed have on the current moves in Congress to crack down on some credit card industry practices? You know, they've talked about, for example, getting rid of universal default, where if you have a problem paying one card, it affects interest rates on all of your other credit cards as well. Is that something that you think will continue to move through Congress?
That's difficult to say. I mean, I think one is largely dependent upon the other. When we start to get a sense for what sort of final revisions will be made to the disclosure agreements, I think that will govern a lot of what you see from not only credit card companies, but also what you see from Congress going forward as well.
All right. Greg McBride is a senior financial analyst with Bankrate.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org, and by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding, online at nasdfoundation.org.
No doubt many of you will be putting your credit cards to good use this weekend. It's the official start to the summer travel season. Now, it's not like we don't want you to be relaxed while you're on vacation, but travel time also means home invasion time. The National Burglar and Fire Alarm Association estimates a burglary is committed about every 15 seconds in the U.S. For that reason, one in four homeowners invests in security systems. Are they worth the cost? Marketplace's Jeff Tyler looks at the price of protection.
According to the Justice Department, the average loss per burglary is about $1,700. Compare that to the cost of a home security system. Mark Sepulveda with USA Alarm Systems in Monrovia, California, says the price
could range anywhere from about $200 to about $2,000, depending on the size of the property.
If you just want an alarm that makes noise, Sepulveda can set you up with one like this.
It does not include monitoring. You know, it just makes a local sound at the property, does not go into the central station, which we do recommend, and most alarm systems are monitored by a central station.
So when your alarm is tripped, the company notifies the cops. That monitoring costs an additional $15 or $20 a month. Susan Brady, editor-in-chief of Security Dealer Magazine, recommends spending $1,200 to $1,500 for a quality system. She says you can find cheaper models.
As low as, say, $90. But they're very basic, and they come with long-term contracts, like a 2 or 3, 4 year contract that if you try to get out of could cost you more than even some of the high-end systems are worth.
The high-end systems come with powerful 30-watt sirens. But not everybody needs that.
Don't waste your money. Make sure the product you're buying is going to work for you.
That's Frank Burke. He's a retired cop and now an executive with USA Alarm Systems.
Are we wise to sell them a $5,000, $10,000 alarm system when they're trying to protect a lamp, a TV? No, that's not wise. I think you develop a system designed around what their needs are.
These days, many security systems include a fire alarm. What else do you need? How about a monitor for carbon dioxide in your home? Do you need surveillance cameras that send video clips to your cell phone? Mark Sepulveda can even install temperature detectors.
If there's a temperature that gets too high or too low, let's say a vacation home, your cabin may get too cold and the pipes start breaking, things like that.
These add-ons cost extra, as much as $150 for additional hardware, plus a couple bucks more per month for monitoring. In addition, you need to factor in the cost of an annual permit. In Los Angeles, permits run $30 a year. That's cheaper than the fine for not having one, says George Gunning, president of the National Burglar and Fire Alarm Association.
In one city, it's like $300 for not having the permit.
And if you trip your alarm by accident, you could end up paying the cops, too. In Los Angeles, the police charge upwards of $100 for each false alarm. On the positive side, there are some financial incentives that offset the cost of the system and the permits and the potential fines. George Gunning explains how an alarm system can save you money.
The person that puts in an alarm system normally gets somewhere between 15 to 20% discount on their insurance policies.
And if you really want to pinch pennies, you can psych out crooks on the cheap. Even if you don't own an alarm, you can advertise as if you do, with a sticker or a sign placed in your front yard. Again, Mark Sepulveda.
Statistics show that any type of signage that you have in your home does deter. They'd rather go somewhere else where they don't have a system.
And for just the cost of kibble, you can invest in the oldest kind of alarm, the canine kind. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
Feeling financially insecure? Drop us a line at marketplace.org and click on contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. One of the most aggravating things about traveling by plane, aside from long security lines and seats that force you into the fetal position, buying your ticket, then 2 weeks later finding the same ticket for $50 less. Well, several new websites have cropped up recently to help you figure out the best time to buy. And one in particular is putting its money where its mouth is. Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into it.
Let's do a search for flights to San Francisco from New York. Faircast.com not only lists the lowest fare out there, $379 for my dates, it also predicts whether that fare will go up or down. It's telling me to wait. Ooh, prices could drop by $39 in the next week. But what happens if prices go up instead of down? For $9.95, Faircast will guarantee my $379 fare with a kind of insurance policy called FareGuard. If I end up paying more for my ticket, Faircast will pay me the difference. Hugh Crean is the company's CEO.
Certainly, we are not clairvoyant. So, yeah, there are certain situations where we are wrong and we stand behind the prediction and we write that check. But what we find is, you know, as the stats prove out, we're very good at predicting airfare.
Those stats show Faircast is right almost 75% of the time, according to the company. But traveler, beware. Faircast only predicts changes in the lowest available airfare, not the specific flight or time you want. Terry Tripler runs a subscription travel site, MyVacationPassport.com. He says Faircast is useful if you're looking for the lowest fare, but it's probably low for a reason.
I try to convince our subscribers, and I tell them over and over, the lowest fare is not always the best value. Sometimes the lowest fare can be the lowest fare by $50 or $100, but it's a 14-hour trip instead of a 4-hour trip.
If Faircast has its limitations, Henry Hartevelt says it does help lift the veil on a supremely mysterious business. Hartevelt is a former airline executive. He now follows the travel industry for Forrester Research.
I remember TWA was the first airline I worked at, and I talked to somebody and asked him what our lowest price was, and he said, only God knows the answer to that, and he ain't talking. What Faircast does is it shines some light down this very, very complex, windy tunnel known as buying airline tickets.
But there is such a thing as too much information. Dozens of websites offer similar nuggets of travel wisdom. One company, Fair Compare, provides a history of airfare changes so you can see how your fare stacks up. Kayak.com is more near-term. It shows you the best fares other users have found recently for the same route. Airfare expert Terry Tripler says you could drive yourself crazy hunting for the absolute rock-bottom lowest price. He suggests settling for a price you can live with.
When you feel that you have found a fair price, I recommend you take it, relax, and enjoy life.
But for those of us still intent on getting the lowest price, Faircast's insurance isn't the only option. A few days ago, a new website launched that alerts you when prices drop. It's called Yapta.com, and it blows the lid off one of the best-kept secrets in travel. If a fare drops after you've bought your ticket, many airlines will send you a voucher to make up the difference. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
Want to make sure your socially responsible mutual fund isn't actually irresponsible? Chris helps out in the mailbag. And drumming up business isn't just a full-time job, it's an all-the-time job.
They keep asking you, so what are your hours? And I look at them like they've got three heads. Like, what do you mean hours? I work all the time.
We profile a day in the work life of a corporate rainmaker. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Now, here's an interesting job title. Rainmaker. Sounds kind of supernatural. Hardly, because the kind of rainmakers we're talking about don't call forth storms to nourish crops. They call forth new business to nourish their company's bank account. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we get our feet wet with a rainmaker during a high-speed networking meeting.
I'm Andrea Madhouse, so I'm number three. Yeah, and you are
Julius. Number 16.
Excellent. Okay. You're the person I did want to meet with. I absolutely think, because I do a website development.
My name is Andrea Madhouse. I am 35, and I'm Chief Rainmaker at Gigapixel Creative.
So that's my spiel. You tell me about you, and then we can get a little deeper into it. I bring in new business, and that means looking for new clients or looking for other ways that our business can expand, whether it's in a completely different area, new business models, product lines, so to speak. And that's what I do all day long, is I look for ways to make connections with other businesses. Every single day is so fully packed with meetings and just work. It's fantastic but terrifying because I'm working all the time. That's what most people would be surprised with. They keep asking, so what are your hours? And I look at them like they've got three heads. Like, what do you mean hours? I work all the time. That means I go to networking meetings, sometimes starting at 7 a.m. and they end when my brain stops working. Sometimes that's 2 a.m. in the morning. It is intense and I'm not getting nearly enough sleep. And when someone tells me they're tired, I look at them and I think, okay. Right now, I am experiencing a lot of stress. Some of that's because I have a monthly goal that I'm supposed to bring in. I have to bring in a certain amount of business. And so making sure that you meet your quota can be a stressful thing. My company puts that on me, and some of it's just my own ego. I don't want to fail, and so I have a lot of pressure to make sure that I succeed. Well, part of the reason that I'm working as hard as I am is I really do see myself retiring by next year. I know that sounds crazy, but that's my goal. We do web design development, and I hear every single day about all these companies that sell out for $100 million or they go public. I'm not really in that space, but those kind of goals are definitely something that I have in mind for myself and for our company. My salary is just under $30,000, but the majority of my income really comes from commissions with a possibility of becoming a partner. So hopefully when that's all said and done, because I don't know yet, it'll be well over six figures. I've only been there 6 weeks, so that might end up being $1 million. It might end up being $100,000. It might only end up being $70,000 when all is said and done. I can tell you that I turned down four jobs that pay over six figures a year to do this. If you don't love this, you can't keep up. You'd quit after a day. If your goal isn't to hit $200 million, then you would never work as hard as I do. I like to work for myself, so if and when I cash out with my $200 million, I'll just probably end up starting another company. It was a pleasure meeting you, Julius. Thank you.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Sally Herships. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
A problem with the solution to a problem brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, ethanol effect. The biofuel ethanol seems like a great idea, right? Because it's made from good old-fashioned American corn. But guess what happens when you start making more ethanol? The cost of corn goes up, and everything that's made with corn, from corn-fed beef to grandma's corncob pipe. That's the ethanol effect. A recent University of Iowa study says the ethanol effect pushed up food prices by $14 billion last year. It could soon swell to $20 billion. See? It's not easy being green.
Got a box full of letters.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's that time in the show where we listen to you. Here with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Tess?
I'm terrific. But before we get to the questions, let's ask everyone to take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there, or you can give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that MONY. All right, let's hit the phones. We've got Steve calling from San Francisco, California. Hey, Steve.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do there in the beautiful city of San Francisco?
It is beautiful. Thank you. I am an attorney and a writer, and I have a small press.
Oh.
I have done pretty well here. I saved some money in my 401k during the dot-com boom, and my question has to do with what we call socially responsible investing.
Very popular topic for our listeners, Chris, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I hope so. After a few people at work told me it was impossible, I learned that my employer's 401k plan does allow us to choose the mutual funds that are not on the list that comes by default, because the package deal included stock in Altria Group, which I guess is supposed to sound altruistic, but it's actually Philip Morris reborn. I don't want to make money off exporting munitions or poisoning rivers or advertising cigarettes to 12-year-olds. I do want to support companies that treat their employees well and companies that promote things that I believe in, like wind power and hybrid automotive energy.
But you say you have a mutual fund that says it does invest in socially responsible companies, right?
I found a couple that said they did. But when I read the prospectus and I read the fine print and I see the companies that they have money invested in, it's not that easy to find out what companies they have, actually. The only ones they actually tell us are the top 10. You know, I do believe in capitalism as a concept, but then I see a lot of companies there I don't want to be profiting from and I don't want to be supporting. Is there a resource out there to help people with this kind of thing?
That's interesting, Chris, that that his mutual fund only lists the top 10 companies that they're investing in. Is there a way to kind of dig deeper in the dirt within your mutual fund to find that stuff out?
There are several things that you can do. First of all, socialinvest.org is sort of the main portal into the socially responsible investing world.
Okay.
And they have a lot of information on the mutual funds themselves, but also in terms of community investing and some avenues for community investing, because more and more people are putting some of their checking account money or savings account money into small community banks that lend to inner city entrepreneurs and inner city homeowners. The other thing that I'm a big advocate of, and I guess you're aware of this, is I like index funds. And there are a couple of socially responsible index funds. Probably the best known is the Domini Index. It's 400 companies, very low fees, does very, very well relative to the S&P 500, which is what we would normally compare it to. But again, what you've really hit on is a big issue in socially responsible investing. How deep do you want to drill down? If you go to Morningstar.com or the socialinvest.org, and you do the information there, you're typically going to get the top 10 holdings. And the reason why they don't publish as much is they can change. There's a lot of turnover. And frankly, I think that the information should be more available in today's internet world, but it takes a little more digging.
All right, Steve, you ready to dig?
Yes.
All right.
But I do want to say that people should not despair. I mean, you can't achieve perfection, but you can get pretty close to what you think is the way you'd like your money to work. There are all kinds of trade-offs. Perhaps, you know, you would prefer have a different type of labor relations, but what it turns out is, you know, they're not going to have the labor relations you want, but they really treat women well. But I think one of the things that people should not take away is that socially responsible investing is a fool's errand. Mm-hmm. It is not a fool's errand. We always bring values to whenever we spend our money.
Right.
And this is no different.
All right. Does that help you out, Steve?
It certainly does. And I appreciate your being on this issue.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, Chris, how about we hit the email bag? You ready for our first letter?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Joan is writing in from Dearborn, Michigan, and she wants to know a clear and simple explanation of something called crummy powers.
Oy, oy.
C-R-U-M-M-E-Y. What is this?
If you're asking about crummy powers, contact an estate planning attorney. Now, let me break it down. You're a married couple. You have one child. By law, each parent can give that child $12,000 excluded from taxes, right? A year. Now, the one rule we need to remember is that the child then must be able to go ahead and do what they want with the money. Now, let's say that you had a trust. Child might not get that money for another 20 years. crummy powers is a way of giving the money into a trust and still being able to take advantage of the annual exclusion gift. That's really the trick that's going on here.
Doesn't sound too crummy to me. It sounds like a pretty good deal.
It is a good deal. I mean, there's also a lot of other good deals with that because it probably means you're getting a really good inheritance.
Well, hope that helps you, Joan. Thanks so much for the letter. If you think you're the only person who doesn't understand some of the terms bandied about, well, you definitely aren't. I'm right there with you, and Chris is here to help. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right, let's hit the phones again. We've got Yolanda on the line from Denver, Colorado. Hi, Yolanda.
Hello.
How long have you been there in Denver?
Almost 18 years.
And what do you do there?
I'm a cashier or account tech at Colorado State University.
Well, what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I'm planning on selling my home. It sounds like there's a possibility of a short sale. I'm not sure of all the ramifications as far as a short sale. I haven't really been able to get many answers from either my mortgage company or my real estate agent or... And she asked if I'd spoken to an attorney. As flatly, I just can't afford an attorney. So I thought, well, I'll call you all to see if you can help me out with some of the questions I might have.
Well, Chris, this is a term that we're hearing more and more often these days as people can't sell their homes for the price that they owe on them. Can you give us a quick definition of a short sale?
This is for people who are on the edge. You have a choice of bankruptcy, foreclosure, or a short sale. And with a short sale, what you convince the bank to do is to write off the portion of the mortgage that's higher than the value of your home. The reason why they asked you whether or not you have an attorney is that at a moment in your financial life when you can least afford it, in essence, you need a squad of professionals to help you out.
Right. And Chris, as I understand it, I actually know someone who's done a short sale recently. And not only does that put you in a unique situation with the bank, but Uncle Sam then considers that short sale a gain for you. So then don't you owe taxes on that as well?
Yeah. Let's say it's a $200,000. You sell it for $150,000. You owe the bank still $50,000, that could be treated as a gain. It's a slightly strange situation because typically when you try to buy a home, you know, you're proving how creditworthy you are. With a short sale, you actually have to do the opposite. You essentially have to prove that you're broke because in order for a short sale to go through, you know, the bank has to be convinced and everybody has to be convinced that, you know, you don't have other finances that you could tap because let's say you sold the home with the $5,000 loss and you have $5,000 in savings, the bank's not going to cut you a break at that point in time. So as we can already see, there's a lot of issues that come into a short sale, and that's why the person that recommended to you, Yolanda, to talk to a real estate attorney, that's really what they were saying, is that this is a complicated transaction, and you really do need to reach out.
Yolanda, what's your reason for moving? Do you have to get out of the house for some reason?
Well, actually, I do have a second, and it is quite a bit behind, and they did negotiate a prepayment plan, but they gave me until the end of June to make a balloon payment, which I don't have.
Wow.
I don't know why they said that.
So, Chris, given that situation, what's her best next move?
I would really go to an attorney because...
But what if she can't afford one?
It is going to be tough, but the question that is going to be raised is short sale, bankruptcy, or foreclosure, or some other alternative. But it's always best to hire a professional to do the renegotiations. And in this environment that we're in, banks have an enormous incentive to work with people.
Well, Yolanda, I know it's small comfort, but you've got lots of company when you're dealing with this issue. So hope that helps, and best of luck to you.
Okay, well, thank you.
Take care. Well, as you know, owning a home is a dream for a lot of people, but it can be very confusing. There are sticky predicaments that you can get yourself into. And hopefully we can help you sort it all out. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, one more reach into the email bag. We've got Charles writing in from right here in Los Angeles, California. He is in his late 30s, single, and currently earns, good for him, around $160,000 a year. He has about $120,000 saved for retirement. Again, good for him. He maxes out his 401k. Doesn't sound like this guy has any problems. because of his income, he cannot use a Roth IRA. As we know, there are income limits. He's done a little research, and he thinks that in 2010, the rules that govern the Roth, especially these income limits, he's heard that it could be beneficial to change his retirement savings over right now to take advantage of it. So take us through this question about this Roth IRA. Are things actually going to change in 2010, and what should he do?
Actually, this is something that's out there. In 2010, the law will change. Now, we got to do a couple of rules. You can't contribute to a Roth if your income exceeds $114,000. There's an income limit. There's also, you can convert a traditional IRA into a Roth IRA with one important caveat. Your modified adjusted gross income has to be under $100,000. In 2010, you can convert your traditional IRA into a Roth IRA in the $100,000. There's no income limit there. It disappears. Furthermore, for that one period of time, if you do, you can also spread the tax bite 2011 and 2012. Don't ask me why they did that. But anyway, they did it. So people are excited.
So you can take a traditional IRA, which is something that you can get a tax deduction for. The taxes are not taken out until you withdraw. You can take that traditional IRA, convert it into a Roth IRA, and pay the taxes then over 2 years?
Yeah. But then from then on, then it goes back to the 1 year. The problem that I have is, this law still going to be in place in 2010? This is one of those at the margin that strikes me as no one's really going to mount the tax fight battlements to support. You know, it's kind of complicated. It's kind of a small world that can deal with it. And I've noticed more and more people are recommending, you know, maybe what you might want to do is just buy a good stock. That might just be a smarter strategy overall.
All right. Well, there you go, Charles. Hope that helps you out. And unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But please do leave your questions for a future program on our voicemail. Call 1-877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our contact page on our website. It's marketplace.org. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot. And Tess?
Yes, sir?
What would we do without the tax writing geniuses of Congress?
We'd all probably be better off.
Exactly.
You know all those people you see at real estate open houses? Think they're there to buy? Think again.
Some just need entertainment for free, so they go to open houses. And sometimes they get free chocolates.
And there's a lot you can learn from skinflints. We chat with perhaps the cheapest family in America. That's still to come on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. The latest housing numbers came out this week. New homes flew off the market in April. Biggest jump in sales in 14 years. But here's one reason why. Prices dropped by the largest amount ever. Not good news for sellers. But that doesn't keep folks here in L.A. from slapping million-dollar price tags on two-bedroom, one-bath ranch houses. And it doesn't keep people from checking those homes out, whether they can afford them or not. Our own Cash Peters is practicing a new sport of sorts called open housing.
Open housing is a hoot. It really is. You get to snoop around houses you can never afford to buy while pretending you can. Everybody's doing it. Marion Goodman's a top real estate agent in L.A. She says, and I'm paraphrasing here, that most people are delusional, though. Oh, and cheap.
Yeah, some are just totally dreaming and need entertainment for free, so they go to open houses. And sometimes they get free chocolates, like we're giving away today.
I love that.
I may buy it on that basis alone.
Just kidding. Nothing would make me buy it, because that's not the point. The point is to look and criticize. And I do, every weekend, but only at homes valued $3 million and up. That's the rule. I dress in my Sunday best and walk around making comments like I own the place. Or could. You know, hypothetically. The house Marion was showing that day was in Encino, California, and worth $2 million. So technically I was slumming it. It was then she told me, though, and this was a shocker, she told me that dressing up counts for nothing.
Some people are just raggedy looking. They have a lot of money. They don't need to impress me. So the people that come in with torn jeans and flip-flops might be a $4 million buyer.
I'm trying to pass myself off as like Russian royalty or something that you'd come in and go, wow, he's got the money.
Russian royalty doesn't have any money. The communists took it from them.
Rats. Anyway, I'm not the only one who visits houses he can't afford. For instance, I found this guy on the patio, and I mean, the way he was dressed, he could have been the pool cleaner.
It's LA, no one cares.
And can you afford this?
No, not even close.
So why are you coming here?
It's fun to see what I have to work harder to get.
So you would come around this place just because...
Yeah, see how the other half lives.
And how you never will.
Exactly.
Why are you here? Why did you come to this?
We're looking to buy a house.
But are you really?
We're really serious.
Wow, how unusual. Real buyers. The house was massive, with a certain LAX Terminal 3 quality to it. High ceilings, great prairies of marble flooring. It even had this weird hose thing that vacuums the house for you, sucking up dust and dander and possibly, if you don't hold on to something, you. Well, Mrs. Buyer didn't like that.
It's a big hose that you have to drag around with you. It's almost better to have a regular vacuum, honest to God.
What? This was news to Marianne's assistant, Fariba Majubi.
You know what they didn't like?
Me.
You were number one on the list. Number two hates the hose in the garage.
I find that totally absurd.
Most likely we will not sell this house at an open house. And that's why I don't like having open houses where people actually live, because people come in and go through drawers.
That's me.
Things.
That's me. When I don't take things, but I go in, I rummage through cupboards, I'm on their phone, I'm busy, busy, busy.
Oh, and in an occupied house, you won't be able to do that.
This is why I would never come to one of yours. I need to be free to roam.
But I need to protect my sellers.
Ugh, where's the fun in that? Don't be fooled, though. I take open housing very seriously. I'm like the real estate version of a frivolous litigant. Turns out that most other buyers are the same. It's one big game. Meanwhile, the agents watch them walk in and walk out and whine about them.
The look on her face is miserable. It's hot. They don't have air conditioning in their car, so they want to cool off.
So they're coming in here just for the air conditioning?
Yeah.
Welcome. Hello. How are you doing?
What a cute dog. You want to keep that kind of dog away from the central vacuum system.
Oh, yeah. You've got a central vacuum system which actually sucked the dog up and deposited in the garage.
Oh, good. Then we'll
keep the dog on a leash at all times.
What are we thinking?
No potential buyers.
Really?
No.
Why not?
He didn't brush his hair this morning.
The fact that he didn't brush his hair means he doesn't want the house. There's no logic to your argument.
Yeah, I know.
Now, what about this couple?
It might be his daughter, or it might be the second trophy wife.
Well, maybe they're seriously buying the house.
Yeah, he wants to impress her. Bigger is better.
Here they come.
Welcome.
They had this certain look about them.
He smelled nice.
He looked good. Her hair looked expensive. And
could they actually feel your drool down their back as they walk by?
Yeah. I'm going ka-ching, ka-ching. I hope they can afford it.
Yeah, right. Well, they couldn't. After all, it's not your dream house, is it? If you actually have the money.
Why are you not buying?
Because I can't afford it.
So why even come around?
Because you want to know what's in the neighborhood.
But do you not feel a total phony when you come in here, looking like you're going to buy the place?
Absolutely not. Everybody does it.
You have no shame?
None whatsoever.
And no, neither do I. So here's what we've learned. First of all, look around for pleasure. Don't dress up, don't ask needless questions, and don't think you're fooling the agents, because seriously, you're not. In Encino, California, I'm Cash Peters from Marketplace Money.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Tightwad. Cheapskate. Don't like being called those names? Well, Annette and Steve Economidis don't mind. They not only enjoy being cheap, They actually wrote a book about it. It's called America's Cheapest Family Gets You Right on the Money. And yes, Economitas, that's their real last name. Hey, guys, just how did you get the title of America's Cheapest Family?
It started basically with a reporter who was trying to write an article on us, and he couldn't come up with a positive adjective to use. Because in our language, there is nothing positive about being frugal. Mm. It just doesn't come across. So he used cheapest, but he opened this segment by saying, I want to introduce you to the cheapest family in the Valley, but I mean that in the best way possible.
Now, this cheapness, if I may use the word, has really been with you for the length of your marriage. How did you two come together in a way that made you both realize the value of money?
Basically, we learned about it, believe it or not, at a church marriage prep class. They had a week on finances, and we both looked at each other and said, have you ever heard this stuff?
And we started off putting money in envelopes. You know the old envelope system? You get your paycheck, you divide it up and put a little bit into rent, a little bit into food, a little bit into clothes. And I was only earning $6.50 an hour, $838 a month take home. And within a few months, we had thousands of dollars sitting in our apartment. And we've been doing it ever since, and it helped us pay off our first house in 9 years. It's incredible.
But what we encourage everybody, because it is a little bit overwhelming, we're going to be married almost 25 years. And
we got married when we were about 3.
Ha, very funny. Anyway, we tell folks, just start out with baby steps, because any decisions you make today are going to start to improve your financial picture, no matter what it is.
Well, let me take you back to an example that you just gave, which is paying off your house in 9 years. How did you do it?
Well, it started with, first off, we didn't buy the most expensive house we could find. And that's a big mistake that a lot of people make. So you buy small and you make a commitment to find ways to cut your expenses so that you can pay that sucker off. And we started, no joke, with $2 extra principal. Over time, we ended up having, you know, $100, $200.
Yeah, even $500 extra each month. It just grew from there. And it was diligence and faithfulness that got us there.
But the coolest thing is, when we got down to the last $5,000 to $10,000, we're going, gosh, we've got enough money in savings. Let's pay this thing off. And it was just so electric to be at that point. And when we did make that final payment, boy, we just celebrated.
Yeah, we did. That was great.
But my guess is that you did not celebrate by putting a dinner on a credit card.
You would be correct,
right?
On that one.
So given that you don't use credit cards, what kind of credit score do you have?
We actually have a very high credit score because we have paid off the first house, and we're almost on the brink of paying off the second one.
A lot of people don't realize that credit scores are not just based on how much you use your credit card, but it's length of time of payments, not having a bad mark on there. We did get turned down once when we wanted to refinance our house because of lack of, what did they say?
History.
Lack of history.
Credit history.
But it was no problem because we ended up finding another way to do it when we refinanced, got the rate lower, and we just started accelerating our payments even more.
Throughout the book, you cite so many people who have come to you and said, I can't find an extra dime. What's your initial message to someone who says, I don't have any extra money. I am living paycheck to paycheck.
Usually what we start to tell people is you need to write down everything you're spending every day, because there's always places to find money, whether it's recreation expenses, clothing expenses, food. You could save hundreds, if not thousands of dollars a year on your food budget. You know, if you know how to buy your groceries smart.
America is one of the greatest places to live because there's so many options here. If you have a need, write it down, put it on a list, and let it sit there for a week instead of running out to buy it. And then go look on Craigslist. Go look on FreeCycle. Look in the classified ads. You are bound to find something. And just adapt this mantra. Never pay retail.
All right. Steve and Annette Economitas, thanks so much for all the great advice.
Thanks for having us, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. Hey, Chris.
How you doing?
We're doing well. And, you know, in our editorial meeting this week, you brought up a book that you recently read called How Doctors Think.
That's right. And it's by Jerome Groopman. He's a physician at Harvard Medical School, and he's also a writer for The New Yorker.
All right. Well, it sounds like you're very widely read, but I'm very curious how you're going to relate this book to our personal finance show.
Well, Tess, I mentioned the book because of a relevant reaction that I had to it for personal finance. Let me explain. You know, Groopman is passionate for patients to be smart consumers when they're dealing with the medical profession.
Do your homework before you walk in the clinic door.
Yes. Now, how many times do we say that when it comes to personal finance?
Absolutely.
And, you know, Tess, I was absolutely exhausted when I put the book down. I mean, think about it. Society expects so much of us as consumers. We're to be savvy when it comes to our healthcare, smart 401k investors, engaged parents, and I could go on and on. So here's the straight story. The demands society is placing on the modern consumer are overwhelming. That's why, when it comes to managing money, my advice is always keep it simple.
Yeah, you know, and how much time do all of us have, really, to do all this research to be informed consumers? Isn't that why we pay doctors and brokers?
That's right. But here's the thing. Particularly brokers love to give you mumbo jumbo. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a secret world. It's called Wall Street. And they'll talk about, now, in your portfolio, do you want alpha tests or do you want beta? You know, you can get lost in this world. And that's why I say, for most people, what makes the most sense is to keep it very simple. Buy index funds, buy these target or lifestyle funds that we've talked a lot about, which are essentially closet index funds that adjust for risk over your lifespan. Turn off all this discussion about these complicated strategies that line the pocket of the middleman and not yours.
But shouldn't we still really be doing our homework, at least at some level? Should we be reading annual reports? Should we be paying attention to earnings?
You know, as a citizen of our society, an active participant in our economy, I'm going to say, yes, you should be paying attention to earnings and what's happening. I wouldn't read annual reports. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of books that we talk about and recommend, you know, listening to this show. I mean, there are things you want to stay up on. So I'm not arguing for ignorance. I'm not arguing for nihilism, that none of this matters. But what I am saying is, you know, there comes a point where we actually do know how to construct a well-diversified portfolio. Once you've done that, go off and volunteer in your community. Mm-hmm. Spend your time with your family. Do some of the activities you love.
But aren't we actually being asked to do more and more? I'll use the word homework again. I mean, you have, you know, new products like health savings accounts and some politicians suggesting that we should all eventually be managing our own Social Security accounts.
You're absolutely right. And this is really a worrisome trend. It used to be you worked for a company and it had a pension. It would be what we call a defined benefit plan. Right. So you'd work so many years and then you get a benefit. Now, today,
and you wouldn't really have to think about it.
You wouldn't have to think about it. A professional who was paid would figure out how much goes in stocks, how much goes in the bonds, you know, the whole asset allocation. Today, you're your own pension fund manager, and there's no way around it in your 403B, your 401K. You've actually raised a very important point with these health savings accounts. In theory, health savings accounts make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You're protected from catastrophe. You have more of your financial skin in the game. And, you know, you're going to be making some judgments. And my reaction is, when are you going to have time to do this? I mean, more and more, we're asking of the consumer too much. It makes sense when you're talking about health care. It makes sense when you're talking about retirement savings. But you take the whole thing, and we need greater simplification. And that's why I think the health savings accounts will never take off.
All right, the straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, we're always keeping it simple, Sally, aren't we?
We are. You know, I like that.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Actually, you do write us, and today we feature some highlights from those emails and letters and calls. First, Jessica Posey wrote in from Novato, California, again. In last week's mailbag, we answered his question about why there weren't photos on our webpage of Chris Farrell and Rico Galliano. We said, hey, there are photos. Well, Jesse found Chris, but he looked for 15 minutes and couldn't find Rico. So I looked for 20 minutes, and I couldn't find Rico. We've fixed that. Amber Patterson listens to us in Bozeman, Montana, and she wrote in to comment on our interview with Leslie Bennett. Leslie is the author of The Feminine Mistake, a book that argues women put their financial lives at risk when they leave the workforce to raise children.
I strongly disagree with Ms. Bennett's view and feel that too much emphasis in our society is placed on money and not enough on family. It is very important to me that I am present when all my children lose all their teeth. I did not have children so that someone else could raise them. Ms. Bennett needs to remember that many mothers today choose to stay home because it is the most important job in the world. Money is money, but family is everything.
Another listener wrote in to accuse our own Chris Farrell of drinking too much government Kool-Aid.
Last week, Chris and I debated the merits of so-called core inflation figures, which strip out the costs of food and energy. Stephen Galperin hears us in Litchfield, New Hampshire. He writes, the CPI has reached the point of having no relevance in a normal person's life. My majority expenses in order are housing, food, and energy. The fact that the prices of the bottom 10% of my expenses have not changed does not fix the problem that my wages have stagnated. Your program is starting to appear more and more like a platform for the uber rich to tell us about how great the status quo is. And finally, Anita Foose writes in from Murdo, South Dakota, about our story a couple of weeks back on hypermiling. Hypermilers do whatever they have to go as far as they can on a tank of gas, including drafting behind semi-trucks.
Not only are some of his actions illegal, as noted by the trooper on your segment, but they are illegal because they can get people killed or seriously injured. I am dismayed by your apparent endorsement of the reckless disregard for the safety of others to save a buck.
We'll gladly take your comments, compliments, complaints. Avoid the curses if you can. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, how to get what you want from your boss. Some call it persuasion. Others?
I'd point out that you're manipulating me right now because you're smiling and you are at least feigning, if not expressing sincere interest.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tessa Miglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
American Public Media.